What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson. Let's get this started. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This week, we're going to be talking about the big C, cancer, and our opinions on it and what we think a good option for treatment would be. But first, let's do a little check-in. So what's been going on with you?
Nothing pretty much that new. I've been still training for that marathon. This week I was supposed to run 5 miles. Unfortunately, my shins started hurting like a bitch after about a mile and a half.
Really?
So I was like, all right, I try to push it. I was like, you know what? This is going to happen even during the race. So it's something I got to get used to.
This is outside?
No, luckily I was at the gym, so it wasn't that bad. I haven't ran outside yet because of this. I'm waiting for this, waiting for like my body to be a more efficient runner before I start running outside. So instead of just wasting that training day, I biked for an hour and then I was like, oh, my legs are taxed right now. This would be the perfect time to run. So I went back on the treadmill and sure enough, after about a mile and a half, my shins started kicking up again. And then after 2 miles, I was like, all right, I'm done. So overall, it was about 4 miles ran and then I biked for about, it was like 17 miles. So I'm thinking I still got a pretty good workout in. Like my legs are, this was on Monday, my legs are still pretty sore from it and I've done foam rolling, yoga, like a few sessions of both of them, hot tub. I've been trying to do all as much active recovery as I can because I'm just, you know, every other day I'm taxing my legs a lot. So
I think that was How long were you at the gym?
I think about 2 hours. It was supposed to be about an hour, like 45 minutes on the treadmill and then like 30 minutes on the bike and then 15 in the sauna, something along those lines. But just because of the...
Like my expecting it to hurt that bad.
Yeah, so I had to spend a lot more time on the bike. But, you know, 4 miles running, it's not too bad.
And you're just getting started.
Yeah, so that's why I'm doing those training sessions in the gym, is just in case, like, you know, if my shins start hurting.
And you're 5 miles from home.
Yeah, it's like, okay, what am I going to do? Just walk home? That's like a waste of a training day. If I'm at the gym, it's like, oh, there's a bike right there, or there's an elliptical. I don't know if that would have too much relief on it or not. That's why I went with the bike. And just, yeah, I made sure that I wasn't just sitting there chilling. I made sure I was keeping my RPMs between like 100 and 130, somewhere around there. And the intensity level was up too. So I was making sure I was getting a workout and not just taking some leisurely stroll on the bike.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah. Other than that, all my other training sessions have been great so far. That was by far the worst one. What's new with you?
Well, this week, still doing my little cut to Thanksgiving. It's actually been funny. I'm kind of transitioning back into my old, like, bodybuilding days. Like, if you think back in the day, eating 6, 7, 8 small meals a day, you know? So, when I initially started this, I was doing 2 meals. Then I went to 3 meals within an 8-hour window. And now every once in a while, if I'm hungry in the evening, I'll have a meal right before I go to sleep. So, like, last night, I had... It was like ground beef post-workout, then I had hard eggs, I had some goat, and then I got home and I was kind of hungry, so I had a can of tuna before I went to sleep.
Just eating animals from everywhere, everywhere you possibly can. It's like an entire farm, and you know, just be careful, let me get some fish from the ocean too. Everything.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I stumbled on some goat at the store, and it's super lean goat. It's as far as the whole package, it was like 100 grams. Of protein and then 8 grams of fat.
So that's really lean. That's
super, super
lean. That's like chicken breast level.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, oh, nice. Like, I'm glad I stumbled on that because right now that will fit into my regimen. So I picked up some of that. And so far, I'm so good. Getting leaner. Don't feel too bad. Actually, don't feel bad at all, honestly. I do feel hungrier, no doubt about it. But that's the name of the game when you're doing something like this. And last week, I finished that book, Sapiens. I think it's Sapiens, A Brief History of Humans. And it was interesting. It was long as shit. It was like the size of a Bible. It took me a few weeks to finish. But the reason I really wanted to read it, because most of my arguments, I guess both our arguments on nutrition are ancestral based, you know? Humans have been around for, you know, 2.5 to 4 million years, depending on where you draw the line. So... we should be eating how we've ate the last 99% of our evolution, not just this last 1%. So I thought, you know, let me look into that. And it went into that situation of how early humans ate, and it totally backed up my train of thought as far as how we should be eating. Pretty much, humans are really good at killing shit, pretty much.
Yeah.
Everywhere humans went, like megafauna, which are just big animals that you can see, think elephants or like deers, bears, buffalo, things like that, they died. Like mass extinction around the world. Like as soon as we don't know really how humans got to Australia, because how early man built a ship capable to withstand the oceans is kind of, it's still a mystery, but they did. And as soon as they got to Australia, everything there that was like big and fatty and meaty died. And it's like clear as day.
Isn't the same thing true about North America? I don't know if the evidence is as strong, but like there's no more giant sloths or anything like that anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as like they start in Africa and then spread out kind of to China, so up to like the Russia area, just north, and everywhere they went, all the big creatures died. And it wasn't until about 10,000 years ago we started agriculture as far as planting wheat and corn and rice, things like that. And that was mainly because we killed everything. We were, like I said, we were real good at killing things. So where you found population of humans, you found populations of just mass murder. So it sounds like you hear like locusts, how they go and they just kind of like murder everything in their path. You can think of humans like that. And it's kind of sad, you know?
We got too good at it.
We did. We got really good at it really fast and things just couldn't keep up with us. But whatever, you know, it is what it is. It turned us into humans, you know. We are humans because you ate meat. It's just, that's just a fact. And so that book was interesting because of that. It went into a lot of other stuff, some political stuff and technology, which I'm not that interested in. Obviously, I'm more interested in the nutrition side of things. Yeah, finished that. I'm onto a new book, which I guess leads into this week's podcast talking about cancer. I got a little, I don't know what it is, a desire to kind of dive into cancer a little bit. So let's talk about that now.
Well, yeah, cancer is a very hot topic. Well, shit, it's been a hot topic in our society for over 100 years. And we're pretty much about at the same spot as we were 100 years ago. So we haven't really made a whole lot of progress. And mostly, I just think we're looking in the wrong place. Like, we started digging a hole looking for buried treasure. We dug down, haven't found anything.
Dug real deep.
Yeah. And instead of like, you know what, maybe we should start another hole somewhere else and like start looking over there, we just keep doubling down. Like, we just keep looking in the same spot. So we're going to talk about the other major theory that comes with cancer. So the most popular theory is the genetic theory. It's your genetics. That's why you get cancer. And then after that, you die. There's nothing you can really do about it, even though there's a lot of lifestyle modifications you can do to prevent it. So the other theory with cancer is the mitochondrial metabolic theory with cancer. This goes back to Dr. Otto Warburg. He made this theory in the 1920s or 19-teens.
Yeah, like 100 years ago.
Yeah, a long, long time
ago. This isn't new information.
Yeah. And basically it just says that a cancer cell will use fermentation as a source of energy instead of oxidative phosphorylation. Which oxidative phosphorylation, you create so much more ATP. ATP is just a fancy way of saying energy. So they're using a very inefficient form of
metabolism.
Metabolism to create, instead of being able to create like 36 ATP with oxidative phosphorylation, they're using fermentation and they're creating like 2.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Very, very inefficient. And they're doing this whether oxygen is present or not. And the result of glycolysis, which they're using, that's the way that they're using glucose for energy. You're only getting 2 ATP out of that, and you're creating a lot of lactic acid in the process. So that's how everybody's able to test for that, is you can see all the built-up lactic acid in cancer patients.
Yeah, that's one of the things. You might hear there's a theory about like pH with certain diets and all that type of thing, and acidic environments cause cancer. But that's not true. We really don't have any effect on our blood pH. It's really tightly regulated. But what happens is cancer causes an acidic environment. And those cancer cells, which are just like white blood cells, or I guess that's when it becomes metastasized, but they can live in an acidic environment.
Yeah, so we're blaming the effect on the cause when it's the other way around.
Exactly, yeah. So the mitochondria are needed to use oxygen for respiration. And what that means is I guess it's kind of complicated. I'll talk and you kind of break it down to make it as simple as possible.
Okay. Right? Sounds good.
Yeah. So you start off, we'll just do glucose because it's the most, you know, it's the easiest one. It also works with ketones and fatty acids, but you start off with glycolysis and you turn glucose into pyruvate. And the pyruvate goes through something called the TCA cycle. And that, the end product of that is a few ATP, but also it's just high energy molecules, NADH2 and FADH. And these high energy molecules go through the electron transport chain. And this all happens in the inner mitochondrial membrane. This all happens in the mitochondria. So you need a healthy mitochondria to do any of this. So these high energy molecules go through the electron transport chain and they produce a proton gradient. And that proton gradient eventually will lead to ATP synthase and you produce a ton of ATP per how much glucose you use. So again, for like one glucose, you get 36 ATP instead of two. So that's an 18x increase in the amount of ATP produced. So at the end of the electron transport chain, oxygen is there and it takes up these electrons and creates water. So you need that oxygen at the end of the ETC to make the, to pretty much to complete the circle. So you need that for healthy cells and healthy respiration. But when the mitochondria gets damaged by many things, by free radicals, by chemicals, by pollutants, by just mutations, and because mitochondria have their own DNA, so when those things happen, the mitochondria gets damaged. And what happens with us in cancer, normally mitochondria, they have control of something called, oh, this is good. What do you call programmed cell death?
Autophagy.
No, I'm thinking, what do you call...
Oh, no, that's just like the breakdown of old damaged cells.
Yeah. You know this term. I just want to talk about the pronunciation because I learned something the other day.
I'm completely blanking on it.
It's like a balloon. What happens with a balloon? You blow it up all the way.
Apoptosis. There we go.
Okay.
I have to Google that.
So you just pronounced it apoptosis, right? So that's programmed cell death, and that's modulated and controlled by the mitochondria. You would think it'd be controlled by the nucleus, but it's not. It's controlled by the mitochondria. But I just learned recently, everyone pronounces apoptosis. Apparently that second P is silent. Did you know that?
I did not know that. That's why I pronounced it apoptosis.
So it's actually apoptosis, and the second P is actually silent. Even though you'll hear most people talk about it everywhere, and everyone says apoptosis. So, but I just want to put that out there. But when the mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondrial chromosomes, get damaged, they are no longer able to perform this function, which is just a programmed cell death. It's orderly, it's clean, the cell gets broken down to components, parts, and they get recycled and reused by the cells surrounding it. It's normal, happens hundreds and hundreds of thousands and millions of times in every cell in our body throughout the day. It's very normal. But when the mitochondria is damaged, they can't perform this function. So the cell, instead of dying, it reverts back to this primitive form of metabolism, which is fermentation. And then it's called de-differentiation. If you think all our cells start off as stem cells, like a blank slate, and then they differentiate into different cells, like skin cells, liver cells, eye cells, all doing a unique role as part of a whole organism, as a human. So these cells get damaged, they de-differentiate back into a basic cell, and they just replicate when they're not supposed to. And that's really how you get cancer, is when the mitochondria is no longer able to perform apoptosis. And it reverts back to this old cell, and it kind of just takes over.
So a quick little definition on apoptosis, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the cell's damage, your body's telling it, hey, you're damaged, don't reproduce, commit suicide. That's what apoptosis is. Basically, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and by a little of it, it's a lot more complicated than that. That's an oversimplification. Autophagy is a cell's damage, so another cell comes, eats it, and cleans it up that way. So they're both resulting in cell death. Just one is suicide, the other is homicide, basically.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, I like that. Uh-huh, yeah. But yeah, did that make sense? Talk about the electron transport chain a little bit, how vital that is.
Yes, I mean, if you don't need a degree in biochemistry to understand all this stuff. I mean, the simple way of putting it is, it just goes back to a very, very primitive form of metabolism, and it's not effective. So there's really like no benefit to doing that. So which you can tell that the cell is damaged and that is caused by, like you just said, the toxic environment that we live in. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the toxic food that we're breathing or that we're eating, all the pollution in the air, the water that we're drinking, I mean, everything is just toxic. That's just what we've done to the world.
Well, actually, I don't want to touch on that. Fermentation occurs in the cytosol. So we can perform fermentation without mitochondria. So that's another key reason we believe the metabolic theory around cancer is correct, because you can't ferment without mitochondria. You can't burn fatty acids. You can't burn ketones without mitochondria.
And so we're going to send links to two podcasts that we've listened to. They're both from the professor Thomas Seyfried. Very great podcast to listen to. I highly recommend everybody listen to them. And what he touches upon is there's a study in where they took the nucleus from one cancerous cell and put it in a non-cancerous cell. So according to the genetic theory of cancer...
Which is the nucleus is the centerpiece of that theory.
Yes. So if when you remove the nucleus and you put it in a healthy cell, you don't get cancer.
And this nucleus is from a cancerous cell.
Yes. So you remove the nucleus from a cancerous cell, put it into a healthy cell, you don't get cancer. So the genetics is not the problem. But if you do the opposite, you do get cancer. So that means that it's not in the nucleus, it's not in the genetics, the problem is somewhere else. And that problem relies on your metabolism and not in your genetics.
When he says the opposite, when you transfer the mitochondria from a cancerous cell into a healthy cell, you do get cancer. Because that cell doesn't have healthy mitochondria and it reverts back to fermentation. So that shows that it's not really the nucleus that's a problem, it's the mitochondria that's a problem.
In other words, your metabolism is messed up, not your genetics, which yes. is where everybody's gone wrong with this, dating back for the last 100 years. So there's a couple different treatment options that they're not new, but they're getting more and more popular. So let's kind of touch upon a couple of those.
Yeah, so fermentation has two fuel sources. It's glucose and glutamine. Now, the glucose part, it's very easy to eliminate glucose from the diet. I did for a very long time. You have for a very long time. Simply follow a ketogenic diet, which revolves around high fats, moderate protein, very low carbohydrates. You eliminate glucose from the diet, which cuts off one half of all the fuel source a cancer has. And your body produces ketones in response to this, with response to fatty acid metabolism. And like I stated earlier, you have to have healthy mitochondria to utilize ketones. You cannot ferment ketones. You cannot ferment fatty acids. That metabolism has to occur in the mitochondria. So cancer cells cannot use that fuel. But every healthy cell in our body can.
So this is a study from the NIH. It has Angela Poff, Cecilia Ari, Professor Thomas Seyfried, and Dominic D'Agostino. I know we've talked about him in the past as well. So they did a
study. Yeah, these are studs. These guys are really, I guess, lady too, very smart.
So this is a study just done in just mice. Unfortunately, it's really costly, and I don't know if ethics really go on board with doing these type of studies in people, at least not yet. So they did a ketogenic diet versus a standard diet, the standard cancer treatment diet, and they compared the results. And there was a 57% increase in lifespan with the mice that were in a ketogenic diet. 57%. That's a pretty significant mark. I mean, it's not 1,000% or 500% like we were talking about last week where you need those statistical studies, but it's a lot more than like 5%. I mean, it's definitely outside the realm of error. So yes, you are getting a lot of good results with that. And if you combine the ketogenic diet with hyperbaric oxygen treatment, now you're raising those to 78%. So hyperbaric oxygen is basically you're just putting your body in an environment where you're getting as much oxygen as it could possibly handle. So now what you're doing with that is you're giving the rest of your body all this fuel that it could use with ketones, and then you're giving it a bunch of oxygen as well to help with that oxidative phosphorylation system. So while you do have these cancerous cells that are being starved of oxygen, the rest of your body is thriving because it has ketones and it has all the oxygen it could possibly need to go through that oxidative phosphorylation system. So you're starving part of your body while the rest of your body is able to thrive.
Doesn't that make more sense than our current treatment, which is pretty much let's send a nuke and kill everything and cross our fingers and hope that you're strong enough to recover?
Oh, it's crazy. And so the current form of treatment, or the current standard of care, is chemotherapy, just drug treatment, radiation, and we're hoping we're going to shrink those cancer cells down small enough so we can surgically remove them. Well, we just talked about, by starving them of glucose, we'll have a similar effect without the long list, the pages upon pages of side effects that nobody wants.
Yeah, you know what a side effect of radiation is?
There's too many to really count, but yeah. Like, you're killing a bunch of healthy cells that don't need to be killed.
Well, it's cancer. Like, that'll affect the DNA in our mitochondria. That'll eventually lead to cancer anyways. So it's like we're just hoping, again, like I said earlier, that you kind of survive. You're going to feel like shit. You're going to lose all your hair. All your food's going to taste like shit. And we'll cross our fingers that you live 3 extra months.
So just touching upon that right now. So we're both healthy individuals. We went on a ketogenic diet and got healthier.
Yeah.
What would happen if one of us went on chemotherapy?
Oh, toast.
Do you think you'd be healthier?
No.
I mean, would this even be something that you would even like? What would it take for you to go through that? What would you need in return?
That's a good question. There isn't a price tag on it. There isn't.
I mean, like, all right, if you're looking at, hey, you're going to die in a year, or you can do this chemotherapy, and maybe you'll die in 18 months as opposed to it. Which, I mean, like, that's pretty much what we're looking at. Mostly. Yeah. It's like, that's not really worth it.
No, it's not. And something that's not talked about too often is the side effects of the chemo. Let's say you do beat cancer. You know, pray that you do, you know, and you survive. But there are side effects to it. Down the road, you might get heart disease, dementia, some form of autoimmune diseases that are a result of the treatment used to cure your cancer. So it's not like you're living some scot-free life the rest of your life. There's always going to be a price to pay by these treatments. They're that dangerous. Honestly, vets can't even use a lot of the treatments that we use on humans because they said it's animal cruelty. So I can give your dad a drug and be like, sorry, bro, you're going to feel real shitty for these next 6 months, but let's hope it works. I can't give it to your dog, though, because there's rules against it.
I mean, that's insane.
That's crazy.
We treat our dogs better than we treat us.
Yes.
I mean, that's absolutely insane.
It is.
And kind of touching upon that is the only animals and, like, the only species that get cancer, for the most part, is either humans or domesticated animals that are on a similar type of diet. So, like, dogs, they eat pretty much the same food as us. Or they're eating some, like, super processed dog food. Like, you don't see, like, wolves out in the wild getting cancer.
Yeah, cancer in nature is rare.
Unless they're living, you know, near Chernobyl or, like, some very highly, like, toxic environment. Then, yes, they can get cancer that way. But for the most part, like, you're not going to get cancer in the wild. Because you're not exposed to all the same toxins that we are. Or eating the same toxic diet that we are. Or we feed our animals.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, I want to touch on something earlier before we kind of blow by it. I said earlier that cancer cells can't metabolize fatty acid or ketones. You might think, like, oh, you know, I have heard that certain cancers can metabolize fat. Certain cancers can use ketone bodies for fuel. But those studies have only been done in vitro. And when you look through a study, and it won't say it in the title, but look through like the methods or one of these big ass long tables, it'll say in vitro. That means it was done either in a test tube or in a petri dish. And they'll just get some cancerous cells, they'll dump a bunch of fat on it, and then see what happens. But look for a study in vivo, which means it was done in humans or actually in an animal system. And those studies do not exist. Cancer cannot do that. So don't let some headlines from certain articles online kind of sway you. Look into it. And realize the difference between in vitro, which means in a test tube, or in vivo, which means in a body.
Yeah, which is
I was fooled by that. I was.
Yeah, there's a very big difference. I mean, animal models, yes, mice aren't us, but they are a lot closer to us than a petri dish is. So yes. Yeah, you're not able to draw 100% conclusions from this that are going to be, you know, efficacious for humans, but you can develop a lot more. Better conclusions than you can from just some test tube or some petri dish, because we're far from petri dishes. There's a lot of processes going on. Even if you're an expert in a field, especially when it comes to biology or nutrition, I think if you're an expert, maybe you know 10% of what's going on overall. I don't think anybody knows close to 100% of how the human body really works. We're very, very complicated.
Yes, very true.
So we mostly talked about glucose, but glutamine is another popular fuel source for cancer cells. Glutamine is an amino acid, so that basically means it comes from protein. So the reason that you can't cure cancer from just a ketogenic diet alone is because you're still supplying your body with glutamine, with protein. And you can't, yes, you can fast for a little bit, but maybe you're able to fast for 7 days. There's one guy that's fasted for over a year, but he was gigantic.
And he didn't have stage 4 cancer.
Yes. That's he didn't have all these cells in his body being using some very, very primitive, very, very energy costly metabolism system. So yeah, like you're not going to be able to fast, and I wouldn't really recommend fasting much over doing maybe like a 24-hour or 48-hour fast with this, just because you're going to need all the energy you can possibly get. You want to still be giving your body lots of healthy nutrients, stuff like that. So I wouldn't recommend doing a fasting protocol much more than 48 hours.
Yeah, maybe no extended fast. And we do say that glutamine is a cancer fuel, because it is, but it's also essential for a tremendous amount of other bodily functions. So it's not a bad thing at all. It's just that cancer cells are kind of shifty, and they found a way to kind of ferment it, because glutamine does come from glucose as far as our body can synthesize it. But
yeah, it's not an essential amino acid.
But it should be.
But it, yes.
It's conditionally essential.
Because we use it so much that our bodies can't make enough of it for it. So it's not one of those essentials, but it's
conditionally essential. Yeah, so glutamine is a conditionally essential amino acid. Our body can synthesize it, but we can't synthesize it at the rate that our body needs it, because it's needed for so many other things. Like, it's needed for our immune system, our healthy immune system, to fight the cancer. So on one hand, glutamine is fueling the cancer. On the other hand, glutamine is fighting the cancer. So the glucose part of cancer is easy to solve. The glutamine part is a little bit more tricky.
Yeah. And your body needs glutamine a lot more than it needs glucose.
Yes.
So that's why you can't just go on a 100% fat diet and just hopefully everything's going to be functioning properly. It's not. Don't do that.
Yeah, please don't do that.
You can go on a 0% carb diet, 0% glucose diet. You could be fine. But yeah, 0% protein diet, I think you're going to start seeing some effects. Because protein is just too important. Your body uses it for damn near everything. And even some things that your body doesn't try to use protein for, it can in a tight spot if it needs to. It's that versatile.
It is. Yeah, you think of just fat as a fuel and protein as what we are made of. All the enzymes, all the structures, everything in our body are made of proteins.
And it can be used as a fuel source too, if it has to be.
Yes.
It doesn't like to be, because that's what fat and carbohydrates are for. But yes, it can use protein for damn near everything.
So Seyfried's method for treating cancer, he calls press pulse. So you press with the glucose inhibition, which means just a ketogenic diet. And then you pulse with various drugs that inhibit glutamine. And that seems pretty effective as far as treating cancer. When you finally understand that cancer is a metabolic disease and not a genetic disease, it's just a shame that you can't fully fight cancer from a dietary standpoint. Because, of course, we would love that if you could. But we do think a good approach, if you just recently got diagnosed with cancer, or someone you know recently did, is put them on a ketogenic diet and maybe start them on an intermittent fasting window. You can start them something simple like 8 hours fasting, 8 hours feeding, 16-hour fasting a day. So at 8 to 16 ratio. And then slowly but surely cut that down to maybe one meal a day. And that seems like a good way to fight cancer from a dietary standpoint. And hopefully these drugs that they're all experimental now, and they're all, like, you really just can't go to your doctor and ask for them, but these drugs that inhibit glutamine will become more mainstream and more widely available in the future.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of these types of treatments are going on in other countries. They're not really going on here. Hungary, Egypt, places like that. And also adding to that, when you do a ketogenic diet, there's several different ways you can do it. I mean, the key point is you reduce your glucose to as little as possible. But if you're going to be doing some sort of cancer treatment, I would really recommend lowering that protein to as low as you possibly can, too, so you're limiting the amount of glutamine that you're getting as well.
Yeah, so really, a really strict therapeutic ketogenic diet does limit protein. So I think that's a ketogenic diet you would go to. Somebody like me, someone like you, we really follow more of a, it's called like a MAD ketogenic diet, so a modified Atkins diet. So we don't limit our protein. Like, my protein's through the roof. And yours is fairly much, too.
Yeah, mine is, too. I've actually tried to increase it more now that I'm doing, like, this endurance type of training. Because, mm-hmm. like I said earlier, your body can use protein as a fuel source. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing some, like, long-term, like, long-distance type of events, some, like, really endurance type of events, your body's using a lot more protein than it would be normally. But we're not sick individuals.
If I had cancer, I would not be eating as much protein as I am.
Oh, I would probably cut my protein in a half, or not, maybe even a third of what I
yeah, about a third.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would too.
It'd just be like, what is the absolute minimum I can get away with?
Exactly. Yeah. So,
and that's true for if you're, if you have type 2 diabetes or if you have epilepsy, you're looking at like 80, 85% of your calories coming from fat. That's like a therapeutic ketogenic diet. I'm on 70% fat, somewhere around there, 20, 25% protein.
Yeah, I'm damn near 50-50 right now.
Yeah. Well, you're on a weird diet. That's
not, I am on a weird yeah, I am on a weird
diet. And it's not very sustainable.
It's not very sustainable, yeah. But it's a lot of protein, yeah, compared to my other calories.
And one other thing that Professor Siegfried brought up in the podcast that I thought was very enlightening, I've never heard this anywhere else, but it definitely makes a lot of sense, is when you do have cancer and you're going through all this treatment, you're going to be stressed out, probably. If not the most stress you've been in your life, damn near. So along with stress, cortisol increases. And when cortisol increases, your body releases glucose. Your liver converts the glycogen into glucose and releases it into your bloodstream. So usually when you're stressed out, it's because you have to either kill a deer or fight a tiger or run from a bear.
Yes, stress is a very ancient mechanism. So our body has one result of stress. And it is that adrenaline cortisol release. Because 99, again, go back to our ancestral argument of stress, was a physical stress. Like when we were hunter and gathering back, you know, a million years ago, the stress was, oh, this tiger just turned the corner and it looks hungry. We better run. So that was a stress. That's why our body releases these quick energy sources in response to it.
Yeah, so you're releasing this glucose, this energy source that's basically like jet fuel to the body. And then what you're doing is you're turning your body into a jet and either sprinting as fast as you can away or using as much energy as you can to kill something. Not like now where we're stressed out because we're driving to work and we might be late and we're sitting in a bunch of traffic. So all we're doing is just sitting there being agitated.
Or stress in a doctor's office when you just got told you have cancer.
Yes, I mean, like, you're not doing anything. You don't need that jet fuel. Your body thinks you do, but no.
Your body still gives it to you.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. you don't need that anymore. And, like, what we just discussed is now you have this glucose. You're feeding your cancer even more now. So what Professor Siegfried recommends is that you definitely do something to manage your stress. So yoga, meditation, something along those lines. I've never heard anybody talk about that before, but it makes so much sense.
It really does. It's a great point. And again, there's a lot of facets to this puzzle. You know, there's a lot of angles, and that's one that is usually forgotten. That's one that's usually not talked about, and it's big. You know, that you should find some sort of stress-relieving technique that you can perform every day. It doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be like me or you where we work out for hours, yeah. You know, because we love doing that. But if you can meditate or close your eyes for 10 minutes, do it.
It doesn't need to be the same thing either. You can do a bath one day, a walk outside the next, some yoga, some meditation. You can do all of them on the same day. You know, there's a lot of variants that can go on with that. But his approach attacks cancer from damn near every single angle. Instead of just approaching it from, you know, you don't need to change your life at all other than you have to come and do these treatments. And then hopefully we'll take care of it. Instead of just putting your life in the doctor's hands and the doctor's going to take care of it all, it's, hey, you got yourself into this situation. Here are the tools to get yourself out. Now do it. And it makes so much more sense that way. It's so much more cost effective as well.
That's a blessing and a curse, though.
Yeah, oh yeah. That's why it's not as popular.
It is. Let's go into that.
So this is a very, very big like ethical question. So somebody does have cancer. They're giving a lifespan of, hey, you got 2 more years to live. So the standard of care is we're going to give you radiation and drugs to help shrink down those cancer cells, which have a shit ton of side effects. Maybe they'll extend your life for a year. Maybe they won't. And then you're going to die and you're going to have all these hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in medical bills that you're either stuck with if you do survive, or your family is now stuck with all these medical bills. Is this even ethical? Should we even be doing this in the first place, just to give somebody a lower quality of life that might extend their life a few percentage points? And now their family's life, you know, now they're all stressed out. And even like the last few months of your life, unless you're some billionaire that doesn't really care about how much money this stuff costs, like, you're going to be stressed out because of the financial cost that goes along with it. So even if like you're dealing with the side effects of cancer, like you don't mind the nauseous, that's fine. Hey, you and your wife, you really think you're going to be getting along when you're super stressed out on money all the time? Like, no, it's just not going to happen. Like, it's just, you're putting yourself in such a position of failure. And I don't know, it just doesn't even seem ethically right when there's this other form of treatment that we could use. I mean, it's a multifaceted form of treatment. It's not like it's a one type thing.
But it's cheap.
It has no side effects or minimal side effects. Like, I'm not saying that radiation and chemotherapy should never be done, but it shouldn't be used as a
go-to thing. Yeah. No, it shouldn't. You shouldn't walk into your cancer center on Monday like, hey, sorry, you have, let's say, brain cancer. And then Tuesday, you're in there getting fried. That shouldn't be the chain of events.
No.
You know?
If I go into the doctor and I have a cut on my arm, this first response shouldn't be, I'm going to cut your arm off.
Sorry, bro. Gotta
it's like,
do
no,
it.
No, 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 wait. Can I just get stitched up? And then, like, you know, if I start to see an infection, then can we give me, like, some antibiotics to take care of it? It's like, no. Arm's gone.
Yeah.
Like, no. That should not be your first thought.
It shouldn't. No. Yeah, and that financial burden is huge with all these other more traditional forms of treatment. It's crazy, and it's super not ethical. And the thing is, and this is a fact, it sounds crazy, but a lot of people, a lot of industries are making money off of you being sick. That's just what it is. Doctors are getting paid. All the workers in a hospital, all the staff are getting paid. These institutions are getting paid because of your cancer. Like, you are supporting someone's livelihood. And when people's financial interests are at risk, that's when they fight hardest to keep the dogma what it is. And right now, that is drugs, 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 and then amputations or drug, drug, drugs, and some sort of major surgery to get the cancer out. And those are all very costly procedures.
And the surgery might still be the best form of treatment. But it's, how are we going to shrink down those cells, which is what we're talking about here. So in order to have surgery to remove the cancer, you need to first shrink down your cancerous cells. And the way to do it, you can either use chemotherapy, radiation, which is a standard of care, or you can just starve out those cancer cells. It'll have the same effect.
And
so much more cost effective. The hardest part with doing like dietary changes and lifestyle modifications is it's a lot harder for the individual to stick to it. Because now
you're compliance.
Yeah, it's compliance, exactly. Now you're making an individual give up soda, french fries, maybe their beer as well. And you know what? A lot of people might not want to do that. But the results are, hey, you're gonna live longer, you're gonna feel better, you're not gonna have all this financial burden. I'm willing to bet most people will be like, oh yeah, I can skip my french fries. They don't mean that much to me.
Yeah, I would hope so, because I have heard that argument before that, you know, the ketogenic diet and these other, like, metabolic treatments aren't sustainable, you know, the compliance is low. But maybe the compliance is low in, like, the standard population. But, man, if you have cancer, you have a terminal diagnosis, you're going to die in a year, you don't think you're motivated to eat right? Isn't that a hyper-motivation, like, scenario?
If that doesn't motivate you, nothing will.
Yeah, so I don't think compliance really is a concern there. But I know that gets used as kind of a counter argument for this method. But I mean, I can't relate because I'm compliant as shit just in my day to day life. You know, I'm not that type of guy. But I would hope that people out there that are sick, that are going through these changes, would be motivated to stay on track.
The only thing I can see is like you have your doctor telling you, hey, it doesn't matter. Your lifestyle modifications doesn't matter.
Just keep doing what you've been doing.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's all genetic. So yeah, you can do these things. Maybe they'll help. Maybe they won't. So I can see from a
Yeah, just from the messaging.
Yeah, from that type of angle. It's like, well, I have people saying, hey, I can change my life and maybe it'll help, or I can do the same thing and it won't. So I can see why you might not be motivated just because you're getting conflicted interests or conflicted views. But still, like, if you have a chance to make this, you know, help, like, why wouldn't you? Why not? What do you have to lose?
What do you have to lose? Exactly. The biggest budget that's going to happen, you just have to change your grocery, like, shopping list. That's it. That's where you start. You get diagnosed on Monday. On Tuesday, you go to the grocery store and you buy new things. That's the first treatment.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's like, once you stop eating a lot of the sugary foods, the processed foods, and you do switch to a ketogenic diet, your taste buds completely change. Like, I've never used to like dark chocolate. I can't eat normal chocolate or like milk chocolate anymore. I love the darker stuff. The darker, the better. So, like, my taste buds have completely changed. I've never liked dark chocolate until, like, the last year. So, like, that's just, like, one example. Like, your taste buds will change. And the stuff that you used to love, you probably won't like anymore. And you'll find all these other new sorts of treats. It's not like I hate the way I live and I hate the way I eat. No, like, I found other new foods that I love just as much, if not more, now that they taste good. And they actually make me feel good in the process. So, that is just a horrible excuse not to do. So I think we pretty much wrapped that up in a nice little bow. There's, check out some of the links. This is definitely going to be the best resources that we've had with any of our podcasts. If you want a deeper dive and to listen to somebody that's a shit ton smarter than us talk about this topic, listen to one of the two podcasts we're going to link to with Professor Thomas Siegfried. Do you have anything else to add before we wrap this one up?
Not really. Just give it a shot. You know, cancer affects damn near all of us. It affects me personally. My dad has cancer. It affects you personally. Your dad has cancer. Yeah. So it affects all of us. And just try and spread the word. You know, you don't have to poison yourself. You don't have to irradiate yourself to fight cancer. Like, there are other methods out there. And they are backed by real science. They are backed by just the truth. How our metabolism works. How our biology works. And just give it a shot. What do you have to lose?
Oh, yeah. And the studies that I'm going to link to, they're from the NIH. That is like, most of the time, I don't believe a lot of studies that come from the NIH because they say the opposite of what we preach for the most part. But if they're buying into the ketogenic diet as a form of cancer treatment, then you know it's effective because they have a lot of stuff saying the complete opposite too.
Yeah. They have so much evidence saying ketogenic is good, they can't deny it no more.
Yeah. The NIH is big government. Like, that's who runs that. So if they're admitting to this, then they're, you know that there's some efficacy of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's on to the tip of the week, right?
It is. Yeah. Okay. You have anything?
Yeah. This is a little bit of a different one. It kind of touches into today's topic, but not really. So I've been utilizing this a lot. I know you have as well, is fasted exercise. And so we've been talking about fasting as a part of glucose management. You know, to eliminate all your glucose or as minimal as possible. But when it comes to exercise, the way I've been using it is when I'm doing my like really endurance type of runs, that the 5 mile run I planned to do, but ended up turning into like 18 miles on the bike. I did that fasted. The reason I did it fasted is I want my body to be a fat burning machine. So my body has to use fat as fuel there, because what else is it going to do? It's got no other option. So I'm increasing my body's effectiveness at using fat for fuel because it had to, and my performance was great. It's also, if you're trying to lose weight, you're trying to like lose body fat, if you're trying to lose weight, fasting exercise is the best way to go about it. Or not the best, but it's one of the best like little biohacks you can use. And you don't do all exercise fasted. I wouldn't recommend that. I wouldn't recommend doing some sprints or weightlifting, if you're fat adapted, is okay, but CrossFit probably isn't your best bet, or like some jujitsu fasted probably isn't your best bet. But some like yoga, some hiking, some like low intensity stuff that you don't really need to be going at 100% for a long period of time. That's the type of exercise I'm talking about, where you want to be using that fasted, be using fat for fuel, and you're using body fat for fuel because there's no other fuel source you have available when you're doing that. So that's my little tip of the week. If you have a couple little pounds that you're trying to lose and you're struggling losing them, try doing that. Or if you're trying to turn yourself into like a elite level endurance athlete, it's another little trick to use to have your, you know, how to start tapping into that unlimited body fat supply that you have on your body that unlimited fuel source. And yeah, just become a fat burning machine.
That's a good tip. Yeah, I always train fasted. Well, that's another episode in the books. Hopefully you guys learned something. You can reach us at tntwellnessandnutrition.com. Any questions or concerns, you can email us at tntwellnessandnutrition.com. And also we're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, everything like that.
Yeah, look for us with a blue heart with a flexing bicep. I know I've been promising that we're going to do a Q&A session. I promise you it will come. We found a hot topic last week that we just had to talk about. And this one popped up. We're both very passionate about it. And also this Professor Thomas Seyfried, if you listen to him, like his passion just...
super inspiring.
Yeah. We both listened to tons and tons of podcasts. And when this one came up, we just had to, like, it's very rare that I get inspired because I listen to too many people talk, but listening to this guy, it's like, damn, I don't know why I don't think like this guy does, why he isn't everywhere. This fool should be, his message should be everywhere. It should be taught throughout all the schools and everything. I don't understand why he isn't more popular than how he is.
Yeah, me either.
All right, everybody, have a happy and healthy week.